more I think of the topic assigned for this course, the more I think it was very courageous for you or for me to think we could answer the problem, because the emphasis we're trying to make is upon the thought of the early church. Now, to know what people think, you've got to be pretty nearly mind readers, especially when you don't have records that tell us. And sometimes I think the people themselves hardly know what they think. And we have to deduce, as they do, what they think from what they do. You know that story about man was asked, what does he think? He says, wait a minute till I see what I do. And then I'll tell you. Well, there's something of that is true of our attempt to get at the in behind the life, the thought, the minds of these early Christians who we're trying to understand. And then that means that we are dependent upon dependent very largely upon their actions. I'm not sure that actions always tell what people think, especially when it comes to matters such as we have tonight, matters of worship. Because worship tends to be a series of acts carried out by routine long after the original meaning they had has disappeared. I think that's true in the history of religions in general, that it's felt that in primitive tribes, you hardly know even in the primitive tribe what they mean by what they're doing. It's already become a stereotype, and you have to get behind it. And any movement like Christianity, which was born in periods of civilization and goes back to centuries in its own inheritance to primitive peoples, it's very hard just to say, now, the early Christians did this, therefore this is what they thought. I wish one could do that. I say all this by way of apology for the fact that tonight, as many other nights, I'm going to answer a great many more questions. I'm sorry, I'm going to ask a great many more questions than I'm going to answer. Perhaps I'll answer some questions I don't ask, but the other thing is more my habit of mine to ask questions which I don't answer. Now today, as I said, we will try to look at together, first of all, the part of Christian life that we call the Lord's Supper, and to see if we can what thinking, what feeling lay behind that. And then we will try, if we can, to look at their other experience of worship, as far as we can recover it, and to see what that was about. Now, in the case of the Lord's Supper, even the externalia are not too well known to us. We don't really know exactly what they did, at least not what they did all the time. We know, of course, that according to Christian tradition, it was practiced in the early church, and that this practice was understood by the early church to go back to the Last Supper of Jesus with his disciples. That supper, which is described in the Gospels, at least in three of them, though strangely enough described entirely differently in the fourth, and then also described in the 11th chapter of Paul's letter to Corinth. That letter to Corinth is the oldest account of it, and therefore has certain priority in our trying to get at the history of this event. Now, I realize that some of us here are today quite unfamiliar in our own experience with anything like the Lord's Supper as the early church practiced it. My wife, who's not here, told me that I made a great mistake last week in not explaining why, how the friends escaped having water baptism when everybody else had it. I'm sure she would say that a main duty I have tonight is to explain why the Quakers, of all people, do not have the actual ceremony, which is so characteristic of the church in all its branches and has been characteristic of the churches as far back, apparently, as we can follow them. It's a custom of which the mummery of man runneth not to the contrary in Christendom. This habit of periodic gatherings to participate with one another in a ceremony of some kind, which is called the Lord's Supper, or sometimes called the Eucharist, sometimes called the Communion Service. At any rate, you know what I'm referring to. Even friends have a little information about what goes on in other churches, though somewhat inaccurate. For example, do we know that in the Roman Catholic Church, the ceremony is called the Mass, and is participated in only by the priest, and is understood in the Catholic Church as being a miracle of Christ being incarnated again. Now, the Protestants, when they engage in the Lord's Supper, don't differ. So you see, even today, in the two main branches of the Christian Church, the ceremony, the origin of which we're going to look at, has a quite different meaning. It is the birth or the incarnation of Jesus that the Catholic thinks about. Whereas, we'll have to guess what the Protestant thinks about. Very often, I think, the death of Jesus, which is quite a different matter. And indeed, isn't it true that this importance of Jesus in Christian history is thought by some people to have been the fact that he came and became flesh, and thought by other people to be primarily that he died? You see how the two extremes of his career represent two centers, by no means concentric, two quite different centers of interpretation about Jesus himself. Well, now, apparently the early church was in the habit, as I say, from an early day, of celebrating a little ceremony. It was connected with a meal, and therefore not an extra event. And it was an almost essential part of a meal, because it consisted of pouring wine and drinking it, and breaking bread. And bread was like this French bread. You just can't get it. You can't take it as it's served. It's got to be broken. In fact, it'd be a good deal better in many places in the New Testament to use the word loaf, not bread. The Greek word means a loaf of bread. So it is the breaking of a loaf of bread and the pouring of wine. Those are essential when you participate more than one person in the same material to eat and drink. And whenever there is a joint meal, there has to be the joint participation in the broken bread and in the poured wine. I suspect strongly that they drank out of the same cup, But, however, to get at the cup, they had to pour it from the larger container. So that these acts are the inevitable acts of any group of people that are sharing a common supply of food and drink at any meal. I suppose that in many ways this symbolic act or gesture, so simple, so inevitable, very not at all far-fetched, is the basis of what the Christian Church continued to practice. I've often thought that the modern toast, where people with their glasses lift their hands and then say something and then all drink, is another custom of joint gesture, participating in some symbolical action. Now, the earliest accounts have some differences, and later practice had even more difference. So that one trouble in asking what the Christians meant by this is you've got to catch them all along the line. This thing evolved through the first two centuries, to go no further. And you'd have to know just which period you were dealing with. And the later divergence, as you know, I've already suggested one of them between the Protestant and the Catholic, and even in the Protestant churches, a great many minor changes took place, and a great deal of emphasis was put upon doing the thing in the right way in detail. Now, when you have a simple gesture, you don't bother about detail. I think the same can be said about baptism, which after all was again a sort of figurative gesture. You could baptize any old way. The main thing was that you want to do something that would be symbolic we tried to find out last week what, but whatever that was, something that had a symbolical value like washing. Well, there are a great many different ways of washing. You go out to our kitchen, you see that almost any time. That just depends on who's doing the dishes tonight, how it's done. You know, there's no doing it according to Hoyle. Though there may be habits originate in our kitchen that, heaven forbid that they should be thought the necessary habits in other kitchens. And in the same way, I think it's true that you can see that either baptism, you remember some of the variety that I spoke of then, and the Lord's Supper could be done in a variety of ways. First or last, in almost any meal, somewhere or other, it would be necessary for you to break the bread and share the wine, and you could do it in a great many different ways. Indeed, it isn't necessary to be merely bread and wine. I understand nowadays you can use unfermented grape juice if you belong to certain groups. And I'm not at all sure, but what the original elements, as they're called technically, or substances, were not necessarily just bread. As a matter of fact, in most meals, they had a little something extra with the bread. I admit that bread was a staple, and that the usual drink in Palestine would be wine, but quite customary to have a little something extra. Salt fish, some sort of relish, not butter, but some sort of relish going with the bread. And in various civilizations we know today, there would be something more than merely bread. Honey would be another substance, and there's some evidence that honey was used in these meals. And salt, if you have unsalted bread, salt would be another ingredient. So I say that what we're dealing with is a feature usual in meals, which the Christians speak about as having significance. I think the meal was a full meal, at least originally. That is, it was a major meal of the day. I'm not sure there was much more, very rarely meat, I think, very much more than the bread and wine, but it would be a principal repast. It would be a hunger-quenching and a thirst-quenching occasion. And it is called by the name of the principal meal of the day, which is translated in English by the word supper, though it might be translated dinner. We call it the Lord's Supper, using the Greek word, using this English translation. But whether supper or dinner is the main meal is, in English even, a purely chronological problem, isn't it, with the culture in English life that you happen to be dealing with. We have a description of the way this meal was misdone in Corinth. Happily for us, the Corinthians were not all just perfect observers of the only and proper and unique way of doing the Lord's Supper. And therefore Paul, seeing elements in the way they behaved, told them how not to do it, which gives us an idea partly of how they did do it, and it's also an idea of how they should do it. Although what he's talking about is how not to do it. They came and they brought their food from home. When they came, as soon as they came, they started in eating. And not being guided by electric system of clocks throughout the city of Corinth, they straggled in to their place of meeting, and therefore they straggled or staggered, if you like, their eating. And he says that those that got there early ate up a good deal and had their fill, and people that got there late didn't always have enough. I gather by that they didn't all just limit themselves to their own little lunchbox that they brought from home, but that they brought stuff from home and they shared it and then ate it in common. But if you were late, it's like some other place I know, it'd be it might be that something would have run out. My wife also told me I shouldn't mention such phrases as potluck supper or anything like that, or I guess I could call it a church supper, couldn't I? That's what it was, a church supper, in which you didn't all, well, Paul says now, if really a matter of being very hungry, you could eat something at home. So apparently there was a social element in it and a participating in it, and not merely eating your own luncheon under each other's noses, each person his own lunch. There was a blessing. At some point in the meal, presumably one or more persons pronounced a blessing on the vines. And that custom of blessing food goes back to Jewish meals, pre-Christian Jewish meals. So that's, again, not an invention. The makeup of the group was apparently a mixed people, not all one family, because he wouldn't draw the distinction between the meal here and the meeting at home. It was a gathering of people from different homes joining together on this occasion. I think it required a room, or at least mostly was indoors, in some building, I suppose you could participate in it outdoors. I think nowadays they occasionally have outdoor mass or outdoor communion service. But in general, I would suppose that in some house, a group of Christians met and partook of this meal. I've often wondered whether it required a table. You see pictures of medieval Italian artists of the 13 people sitting at the Last Supper. Whether that's the beginning of the unlucky number, I don't know. You may remember that one of the 13 was not quite in sympathy with the rest of them, and ultimately absented himself. And there's also the question of what posture they were in. If I should ask you, did they sit or lie or kneel? You might, in the light of modern practice, you might say they knelt. In the light of the pictures, you might say they sat. In the light of probable practice in the first century, you would probably say that they lay. You may remember one gospel talks about a disciple who lay at Jesus' bosom. You may recall that in the ancient world, eating was done on your elbow, lying on your elbow, and arranged along the edge, perhaps the edge of a table or in a row, so that someone could pass along to the people in that row. Well, this is all external. I should remind you, we're going to try to find out what they thought. But I want to know what they were doing, what they looked like, and what they were eating and drinking and saying before I try to discover what they were feeling. I think there was some kind of table, not necessarily a dining table, with place at it for each person. And I certainly don't think they sat in straight-backed chairs like this all around, and not in the first century. As a matter of fact, Paul talks about the table of the Lord. Just as he talks about the dinner of the Lord, or the supper of the Lord. And he also talks about the cup of the Lord. Therefore, the cup and the dinner and the table are given the Christian name. They belong to the Lord Jesus. Paul actually is thinking about the cup and the table and the dinner of pagan deities when he's mentioning that. So it's over against Jesus and a kind of something like this on the part of pagan deities. Now I think from the beginning this meal had an element of worship about it. Though, as I say, it might have been a perfectly secular meal. Now, whether we should say that worship was introduced into the normal meal, or whether we should say that meal was introduced into an occasion of worship, that's a little difficult to say. But they belong together, I think. I have a notion, if I may judge from what happens in modern times to seriously minded groups of people, that while engaged in the normal act of eating, after the manner of our culture, a sense of fellowship and response to the divine comes over the group without being formally so done. But it might become customary, and especially with the Jewish custom of a pause to say thanks before me eating, and with these gestures of pouring and breaking, you could easily see that there would be something very close to a worship attitude in this meal. Shall I say then that the Eucharist itself, this gesture and sipping and tasting, was part of a square meal, and that the square meal was part of a gathering, much of it intended for worship. See what I mean? The Eucharist is part of a meal, and the meal is part of a worship occasion. I think that was probably it. Now, for once, Paul says that his account of what Jesus did comes to him from tradition. So that one can say that at this point our desire to mention the pre-Pauline is possible even while we're reading Paul, because Paul in chapter 11 says that this is what he has heard was done. And he is reminding the Corinthians, he must have told them this before. I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you. He said he'd given to them before, that's past tense. That the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, you see that reference to the life of Jesus? The only reference in Paul's letters to an event in the life of Jesus apart from birth and death. Just think of that. Skipping all the way from birth to death. Except one night, the night he was betrayed, he ate this meal. The Lord, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way also the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." That's what Jesus quotes. Paul quotes Jesus saying. Then I think Paul adds in his own words these words: "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." There Paul is giving his understanding of the meaning of the event. The other Gospels, Luke's Gospel, is very close to Paul. At least it has come down in two forms of Greek text, one of which is rather close to Paul. The other two Gospels, Matthew and Mark, are close to each other. And they differ, among other respects, in not having these words, "Do this in remembrance of me." So that just as we had in the case of baptism, one tradition which said Jesus said, "Go out and baptize everybody," and another tradition which says, "Baptism with water, no, but only baptism with the Holy Spirit." So you can say in this case that we have in one body of tradition, early Christian tradition, the statement that Jesus said, "Do this," or "as often as you do it," which is what you could say to anybody about a meal. Every time you do this again, every time you take your napkin out of this ring, you remember me. I gave you the ring. It's in memory of me. Or every Christmas from now on, after this most moving Christmas meal together, every time you come round to Christmas every year, you can think of this one. Tiny Tim, if you like. Every Christmas after that, you remember what happened that last Christmas together. Well, that's perfectly natural. And Paul implies, more than implies, seems quite sure that this Christian practice should be connected with a meal that Jesus took with his disciples the night he was betrayed. And that was the last night, of course, because everything moved right to an end. And Jesus had, even on that day, suggested that what was happening that night might be thought of every time in the future as having meaning. whether the other gospel writers tell the story as they do, thinking more about it as something that Jesus did with meaning at that day, or whether they also are thinking of it as having meaning because of the way Christians ever since have done it, is harder to say. They don't have the words, "Do this in remembrance of me," or "whenever you do it." It's natural to give the other Gospels the same reason, though I think Mark might well have told the story as an event significant only in and of itself and for the life of Jesus. The thing makes sense without any later Christian repetition. It makes sense in our study of the life of Jesus. I've often noticed at the end of Mark, there are several symbolical acts mentioned. A woman comes and anoints his body. A fruitless fig tree is withered. After some words, not a blessing in this case, but the reverse, but after some words of Jesus, it is withered. There are symbolical acts, such as the Old Testament prophets used, often perfectly taking the simplest things and giving them meaning. So it's quite possible that the other Gospels tell this story without thinking of the later practice of the Lord's Supper. But that's not true of Luke, and it's not true of Paul. And it's pretty hard to believe that the readers, and perhaps the authors of those Gospels too, didn't know. For one thing, they tell some other stories which sound to me like reflections of the Christian Eucharist as later practiced. You may remember that all four Gospels tell of the feeding of the 5,000. Well, nothing said about their drinking anything, although if I know that country, I'd be much more interested in something to drink than I would in the bread and the fish, which is what they had. But at any rate, there's a story of people out in the open having a picnic, of distributed food again, and the authors take time to mention that Jesus blessed the bread, and then he broke the bread, and then he blessed the fish. I dare say he broke them. There are only seven or a dozen for the whole crowd. But this little, you know, little bit of sardine fish you put on a piece of bread, and just give it, just freshen up the meal. Well, I don't wish to say that any of the Gospel writers are telling this story without having in mind the early practice. I have no doubt it was practiced when they wrote, and that they were not forgetting it when they tell it. Now, in the book of Acts, to leave these three stories of the Last Supper, in the book of Acts, we have only two verses, I think, really, which have any bearing on it. Of course, it's in the narrative of Acts where we want to know what the early Christians do. But in the second chapter, towards the end, there are these two verses referring to the practice of the first Christians. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayers. They were continuously attentive, the Greek means. They were continuously attentive to those four things. They happened to be four: the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, whatever that is, the breaking of bread, and the prayers. And then four verses later, "And day by day attended the temple together, and breaking bread in their homes, they partook of food with glad and generous hearts." Well, they probably ate on other occasions, but here is a summary of the regular life of the Christians. They met together. They when they weren't in the temple together, they were in private houses, in groups, and in those private houses, they were breaking bread. I have no doubt they were having more than that. It doesn't mention any liquid, but doesn't exclude it, of course. And now, of course, what you do is you take the accounts in Paul and you take the accounts in Acts and say they were certainly the same thing. It must have been done in the same way. I'm not at all sure. We are getting records from quite different sources of how they acted in Jerusalem in the year 30 and how they acted in Corinth in the year 50, or rather how they acted up in Corinth in the year 50. And I don't know that you can draw too much. But certainly, there's nothing any more unnatural about the story in Acts. It stands to reason that these Christians, with what they had in common, would from time to time, besides being in the synagogue with other Jews or going to temple and worshiping there, would from time to time be found in private houses, in their own private houses. And as you do sometime during the day, taking bread, breaking bread. Now, if we may leave the New Testament, and at much most there's only one other possible reference to this at all in the New Testament, we come to later writers. Pliny the Roman described what he heard the Christians did in Asia Minor about the year 115. Justin Martyr, the Christian in Rome, Pliny was a Roman governor, official, government official. Justin Martyr, a Christian in Rome, tells the Roman emperor how the Christians behave in Rome about the year 155, some 40 years later. And there's a book called the Didache, or Teaching the Twelve. And did you find that, anybody, on the...
Yes, I found it that night.
You found that's out on the shelf. Well, there are certain chapters in that book of uncertain date, and I really don't know where in the world to date it. It may be anywhere from 100 to 200 A.D., and perhaps a little later, and not likely much earlier. And I've never seen any good reason to know how one should date it. But it is a fairly early, how it compares with Pliny and Justin, I don't know. A fairly early account of how this church, or this teacher in this church, thought that you should behave in connection with the Lord's Supper. Now that takes us out of our field and date a little bit, but I might just show you how the thing did develop. We learn, for example, that they met, the Christians, according to Pliny, they met in the early morning, and that then apparently they had a little to eat, and then they had a meal in the evening. And they did that on the same day. So that we begin to get a day connected with this. A day of the week, I mean. Although he doesn't say which day. Justin Martyr says that they met on Sunday. And Sunday being a pagan name, the day of the sun, he mentions that. And it was part of their general worship. There was bread and wine. He mentions that there someone presided. And he also mentions that what was left over was sent about to the people that weren't able to get there. So that it was a church supper in which the leftovers were distributed to the absentees by means of messengers who took them away. What you do with the uneaten part of the blessed bread and wine in church today is, I know, a matter of very great importance to certain high churchmen. What's called the reservation of the Eucharist. Do you keep it till next communion day? Or do you pour it out on the ground? Or do you put it out for the birds to eat? Or does the priest take it? It wouldn't be too much, you know, these little croutons that are left over. And a thimbleful, few thimbleful of wine. But it's interesting to see that in Justin's time, it was thought of as, in a way, a matter of charity. And I have no doubt that this common meal was part of the sharing principle. I mean, physical sharing principle of the early Christians, just as in the church supper, the poor bachelor that can't bring a covered dish, or the impecunious family are somehow covered by the covered dishes of others. My experience is that the five barley, the baskets of fragments that were picked up on two occasions are a good deal like what I've seen late Sunday evening after the church supper. And if my wife has something to do with getting the supper, why, she and the rest of the ladies have the problem of the disposal of a few dozen extra biscuits that haven't been eaten, and a rather nice half a cake that's still left, and what do you do with all those things? Well, just saying that in a perfectly natural way, Justin tells that alongside of the sherry and any religious meaning that is given to this meal, there is a charitable aftermath that follows with whatever is left over. Now, I spent a long time in trying to tell you what has happened, and we ought to get at the problem of the meaning of it all. You want to ask any question on the what I call the externalia? Yes?
I've just been wondering, when Paul says that man does not work, neither let him eat, Thessalonians, do you think he has any thought of the Lord's Supper, of this ceremonial supper, when he says if a man does not work, neither let him eat? Would they be excluding someone?
Well, I would suppose that the mutual dependence in the church would not always show itself at these common suppers. But if a neighbor was hungry, you wouldn't wait until the supper time, the common time. You would see that he had something to eat. And that people that didn't have anything to eat would make their fellow Christians aware of the fact without waiting for this religious meal. And that in answer to the man who rung you up at night and said, I haven't anything to eat, you could say, well, have you done an honest day's work today? And you could quote the Apostle Paul to him. I don't know that we need to bring that in.
Would this feast have anything to do with the Passover in your thinking?
Well, that depends on this original account. The original account in the Synoptic Gospels implies that it was the Passover. And I think I might do well just to list as briefly as I possibly can the possible sources of the meal as it either came to Jesus and through him to the disciples, or as it came to the disciples not through Jesus. Now, if that was the Passover meal, as is implied, we certainly know it was very near Passover time, then this would mean that it was like the Passover, and what I said about Christmas then would be relevant. This annual festival, every Passover comes round. When you as Jews eat again your Passover, you, my disciples, you can think of this one. But that's only yearly. And that wouldn't do the book of Acts. Every day they ate their bread with cheer in their homes. And the early church certainly ate it oftener than once a year. They came to you not once a year, but once a week, according to some of these sources, and that once a week on Sunday. Now, beside the Passover once a year, the Jews had a good many other meals. In fact, I think all their domestic meals were marked with some words of prayer from the head of the family. And then they had, besides the family, they had their clubs, religious clubs. And a good deal of thought's been given by scholars recently to this custom of a religious club with a rather formal club meal. A kabura, it's called. A little fellowship group. Well, we have them in modern society, kind of these dinner clubs. Here's a group of men that go out, and once a month they have dinner together and a nice fellowship together. They're not religious. But the Jewish ones would be somewhat religious. Then, of course, we have accounts of Jesus eating after he rose from the dead. And you may remember that when those disciples took him off with them to Emmaus, and they had gotten ready to eat supper on the way, that they stopped to eat supper, and Jesus, as someone had to do, took the bread and broke it, and the way he did it, that opened their eyes. They hadn't recognized him before. He was known to them by the way he broke their bread. You know, all of us do things in a characteristic way. And it may be dark and you may not recognize somebody, but some little gesture, you can tell them walking down the street a half a block away sometimes.
I wondered if it wasn't the duty of the head of the house or the chief person there to break the bread.
Well, I guess somebody had to break it, and it naturally might fall to him. But how much ceremony there was about that, I don't know. I can see that when Jesus arranged this meal on the lake shore, that he would be brought to him because he had the disciples all ready to carry it out. Well, that, of course, is all set up. You know, they sat in rows, 50s and 100 this way, and then they had these 12 disciples as ushers. I forget, don't know what you call them now in the Eucharist, but the official people to distribute the elements, as they're called. Yes, and these clubs, naturally, it was somebody's turn to preside, probably. I don't know how they do it. The Greeks had their own banquets, and they had quite a little to do, quite a purely secular banquets, about the master of ceremonies. Like the man whose business it was to preside over the drinking at the feast in Cana of Galilee. There was one chap there, not the groom, not the host, but some man, the head of the banquet, presiding officer of the banquet, who was the person in charge. Then we have the actual meal, this one famous meal, the Last Supper. We have the habitual meals of Jesus and his disciples before he died. We have a few references to eating with them afterwards. And one very well-known scholar, Oscar Kuhlmann, thinks it's that third precedent in the life of Jesus, the post-resurrection precedent that started the later Christian, so that when he'd gone another time after he'd risen from the dead, they kept on doing what he had done in those precious 40 days or so. Then, of course, we've had lately the Qumran scrolls from the Dead Sea. And the discovery there that that other religious group had its own religious meals. Nothing surprising in that, and yet I think nothing about those meals that gives them a special right to be connected with the Jewish element in the Christian Eucharist. Those scrolls merely prove that customs that we've known of already in Judaism were practiced in this other Jewish sect. So that if you want to think that this custom mediated through the example of Jesus, goes back to some one or another of the Jewish practices with their blessings, with their club life, why you can do so, and these new discoveries merely show you how natural it was for any Jewish group to evolve in this direction. I want to point out one difference between the Lord's Supper and baptism. That whereas the Qumran people repeated their rites of washing, the Christian didn't, not in this kind. But both the Qumran people and the Christians and the other Jews had, as you would have to have, meals more than once in your lifetime or even once in a year, and that this meal, therefore, was a recurrent meal. Of course, you can go back, if you like, to those feedings on the mountainside. So you can go back to several precedents in the life of Jesus as having set the example. Or, if you like to say, Jesus definitely expected this practice to be done. And you have those words of Paul, quoted from Jesus, which could mean either, when you do it in remembrance of me, or do it specially in order to remember me. Now, a great deal depends on which way you take that, as to whether you think you have a literal command of Jesus for the celebration of the Lord's Supper. I can only say this, that the Gospel of John has no such command, but at the very same meal he has a most explicit requirement that as I have washed your feet, so ye ought to wash one another's feet. And the number of Christian sects that practice that explicit command is far lower than the number of Christian sects that practice the less specific and clear command about doing this in remembrance of him. Of course, there's nothing wrong in doing it without its having been commanded. And indeed, a great deal to be said for it, as people that do it and appreciate tell me. I suppose the reason the Quakers in general have not practiced is they think that the genius of Jesus was away from rites and ceremonies. Jewish in the first place, and therefore less likely to deliberately, clear-headedly establish a new rite. And if you want one practical thing, I may say that there have been more church separations on how to administer baptism and how to celebrate the Lord's Supper than on any other two subjects in the Christian religion. So that when you have an ecumenical conference at Amsterdam and want to have a really complete fellowship of all the churches present, there's one kind of service they can agree on, and that's a Quaker service of silence in which there are no outward elements, distributed by no physical persons and no selected clergy that you can say. Well, now, what did the whole thing mean? I think we'd have to ask again, what did it mean in when Jesus did it that night? What did it mean in those days that they met after his resurrection? What did it mean after Jesus had left them and the Christians practiced it, breaking bread every day at home, communities of them? What did it mean to these Gentiles at Corinth who had not been brought up as Jews, who had not blessed their bread at common meals, these non-Jewish Christians? Now, for them, it might have been something quite new. For them, it meant connection with an entirely new deity, because the God of the Jews had not been their God, as well as connection with an entirely new Lord, namely Jesus. So that this question is going to lead us to a good many possible answers. Taking it in the first as given and what Jesus said. Apparently he's talking about his death. He's been expecting his death now for weeks, mentioned it as coming. This night he has a premonition. He knows what Judas is thinking about. And he says, unthinkingly, he goes through the usual action of picking up this long piece of cake, unleavened cake, if you like, if it is Passover. It's, the only difference would be it's unraised bread in that case, unleavened bread. As he breaks it, he thinks to himself, what's going to happen to my body? Broken all to pieces. And then the other thing that he does naturally, pouring the wine into the cup, for then passing the cup around and the drink out of it, his famous chalice of the Last Supper. He's thinking of the pouring of blood. Rather morbid, if you like, but a very natural thing. A man in that position, everything pays into the thing uppermost in his thoughts. Uppermost, not in a selfish sense, but because he has confidence in its wider meaning. According to the accounts, he puts in broken for you, or broken for many. Poured for you, or poured for many. He is therefore, just as when a woman anoints him, he's thinking of as the anointing of a dead body, so he's thinking here of the meaning of a martyr's death. A vicarious death. That makes entire sense. And insofar as his thoughts recurred to later Christians, you can see that the later Christians would think the same thing. I expect they do. I think one should. You don't see the bread broken. It's all chopped up, isn't it, and on a platter. The wine comes up in these little cups, so it's not so obvious in the modern service as it would be if a dozen of you were sitting around and someone poured it out. You hear the thing splash into the cup. Another phrase that Jesus uses is the word covenant. Covenant. Well, now covenants in the Old Testament were agreements between God and men, mostly for men's interest. They also were serviceable acts for the welfare of men. They were the way in which God ratified a promise to Adam, to Noah, to Abraham, to Moses, four famous covenants. The book of Jeremiah had long talked about a new covenant. And Jesus, remembering first thinking of the wine as blood, then thinking of blood used regularly in the Old Testament covenants, said, and by the way, I said blood, but it's a blood for another kind of covenant, isn't it? A new covenant. After the famous four in the history of the Jews, here is the prophetic expected covenant. Well, that's a thought that has played a great deal of influence in the interpretation later. I'm thinking of it just one of these thoughts sort of struck out at the time and easily picked up without any great theological elaboration, and continuing in simple-minded Christians to think of it. Covenant. Paul says, every time you drink it, you show forth the Lord's death. Sort of reenact his death. You're doing, you're pouring blood, you're breaking a body, not a real body, but the thing that you could say, so to speak, as a child does. Now this is my body, and this is my blood. Now, when you say that a miracle was worked, and that the bread and the wine was made into the bread and body, are you, well, you're doing what the Christians soon begin to think, or perhaps not so soon, but ultimately. If you take seriously a child saying, now this represents blood, and this represents a body, just playing with some things on the dining table. Or an adult saying that in the same prophetic way. One of these days, you're going to say that the body and blood of Christ is actually in the elements, and that as you put them in your mouth, you're eating and drinking the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. And in the Gospel of John already, you've gotten someone playing with that phrase. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood shall have eternal life. Well, now you can go back into all kinds of pagan and traditions and find parallels, that sort of thing. This idea of eating and drinking being done in company with a god, or even in the god. Primitive man apparently thought that the deity got into the animal, and then he killed the animal, and he poured out the animal's blood and tasted a bit of the animal's flesh, and he had just that much deity in him. Well,